From the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Gaudette. Before we get started today, we want everyone to know we will be talking about issues that may be upsetting to some listeners. We're talking about the recent controversial U.S. Supreme Court decision that overturned Roe v. Wade. We will talk about abortion. We'll talk about pregnancy as well as medical procedures. And most importantly, we will hear from you. We will be playing voicemail messages from listeners, some of whom have very strong opinions about this topic. Here is just a small sample of some of those voicemails that you sent us.
I'm relatively conservative on abortion issues. However, I feel really compassionate on those who relied on abortion as a solution to their challenges when faced with unplanned pregnancy. We cannot minimize the burdens that women face in reproduction. And these challenges aren't going away for these women.
My youngest son, when he was conceived and in the womb, there was another fetus growing in the womb that had significant problems to the point where it threatened the entire pregnancy. And had I not had an option of aborting one and not the other, the other would not have survived.
I think it's tragic that they did that. They're such hypocrites when it comes to my body, my choice. They should change their slogan to your body, my choice.
In Idaho, we should explore alternative solutions to these problems. What are other resources they have to mitigate these challenges? If I am pro-life, I am also pro-life of the biological mother. So what can we do as a society to help them? The reproductive burden is too hard to do alone.
So these people that are making these decisions, Clarence Thomas and the others in our state legislature, are playing God. They are putting themselves above the personal relationship that we have to make decisions, to choose what is right and wrong for ourselves. And when we get to that point in a society like this, there's really little freedom left for all of us.
Those are the voices of some of our listeners after they heard that Roe v. Wade was overturned. And we hope that by having this frank and honest discussion, that we can answer some questions about the recent court decision, about Idaho's laws concerning abortion, as well as medical questions that you have sent all of us. So let's get started. On June 24th, just to recap, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the 1973 Roe versus Wade case and gave abortion rights back to individual states. That includes Idaho. Now, in the past, Idaho's conservative legislature has passed abortion laws, which have been successfully challenged by groups like Planned Parenthood. But today, we're talking about two Idaho laws that will directly impact the ability to get an abortion here in Idaho. So joining us right now to explain what's happening with this law, with both of these laws, rather, is our reporter, James Dawson. Jimmy, it's nice to have you back.
Hey, good to hear you. Good to hear your voice, Gemma.
Yeah. So Jimmy, right now, what is legal here in Idaho? Can someone still get an abortion right now?
Yes, women still have the same legal rights that were in place before the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, for now anyway. And that means abortions are available until about 24 weeks of pregnancy or so, what's called viability. And Idaho also does have a 24-hour waiting period where the patient has to get counseling from their provider. Then they have to wait a day before they can undergo the procedure or receive medication to induce an abortion. Now, that waiting period can be waived if the life of the mother is threatened.
And then do we have abortion clinics here in Idaho right now? And I ask that because a lot of states closed their clinics down.
Right. Yes. So right now we do have two in Idaho. One is in Meridian and the other is in Twin Falls. Now, Planned Parenthood merged its Boise and Meridian locations just a few weeks ago, saying it was kind of a business decision. When I've spoken with them or been on press conference calls with Planned Parenthood officials, they said that they have no intention of shutting down those clinics, should these two Idaho laws that we're going to talk about go into effect. But it's a legitimate question as to whether or not they will still operate here in the weeks and months and years to come.
Okay, so you mentioned these two laws, Jimmy. Let's start with the first one. Idaho has one law in place though it is being challenged in court. And then there's another trigger law that's set to take effect 30 days after the Supreme Court's official opinion was published. So can we start with what's being called this Texas-style abortion law that was passed by our Idaho legislature this year? What does that say?
Right. So as you said, this law is being challenged, so it's not currently in effect, thanks to a court order. So if it does go into effect, it would ban abortions after about 6 weeks of pregnancy, which is typically before a mother knows she's carrying a child. So if a doctor performs an abortion after that time period, they could be sued by a family member of the aborted fetus. You know, we're talking about the father of the fetus, aunts, uncles, grandparents, things like that. And that family member could get no less than $20,000 in damages from a doctor, and they'd have up to 4 years to file a lawsuit. Now, if the fetus was conceived through rape, the father could not sue, but his family members could, which has domestic violence advocates furious.
Okay. Now, as you mentioned, that law is being challenged. And I want to now look at Idaho's trigger law. So what does that say?
Yes. So that basically says that no one can get an abortion except for, three narrow circumstances. And those include rape, incest, and if the life of the mother is threatened by the pregnancy, not the health of the mother, the life of the mother. There are extra hoops to jump through to get one of those exceptions. A woman would have to file a police report documenting the crime and then give a copy of that to her abortion provider. And that's not really realistic, since police reports aren't a public record until after an investigation is finished, which can take up to several months to more than a year. And the exception covering, the life of the mother is also in question by groups around the country. You know, would it only apply if the woman would die in the next hour after being admitted to the hospital? What if, her care team knows that it would eventually threaten her life during labor and delivery, but it's not necessarily an immediate thing? Would the woman have to carry the fetus up until that point to avoid a doctor being criminally charged? There are just lots of questions still left to answer.
Okay, so then talk about this 30-day trigger, though, Jimmy. So when is this law, I guess, supposed to go into effect?
Yeah, this is something I didn't actually realize, but the opinion that we all got the day that this was decided back in June isn't technically the final decision. Like, there's not going to be any kind of substantive changes made, but there's kind of another copy editing process that happens. That takes a few weeks, and that when that's finally issued, that's when the 30-day countdown of Idaho's trigger law takes effect. So essentially, we're looking at mid to late August for that law to take effect.
Okay, so let's talk about both of these laws, because they're both being challenged. So what's happening next month, I believe August 3rd, at the Idaho Supreme Court in regards to these two laws?
Yes. So Planned Parenthood filed lawsuits in a bunch of states just a couple days after the decision came down from the Supreme Court last month, and that includes Idaho. And like you said, yes, August 3rd is the day when both of these cases will come before the Idaho Supreme Court. So several things are in the air. Justices have floated the idea of maybe combining the cases, which is something the state has objected to. They've also said they might, kick the near total ban, the 2020 trigger law that's set to go into effect in mid to late August, down to a lower court to go through a lengthier judicial process. That's very technical and inside baseball. But obviously that's not something Planned Parenthood wants to see either. And the court could also just straight up dismiss these cases if they wanted to. In a legal filing, a week or two ago, they kind of questioned the legitimacy of Planned Parenthood's arguments that were kind of based on, Roe, which is obviously not the law of the land anymore. So needless to say, it's going to be a very consequential day for a whole lot of people.
And Jimmy, you actually had a story about how some lawmakers here in Idaho want to ban nearly all abortions, and they want to do this by amending our state's constitution. So a couple of questions for you. Why are they suggesting that, first off, and then how would it work? And then ultimately, any chance that would happen?
Well, some of them are afraid that the Idaho Supreme Court would strike down one or both of these laws because of an implied right to privacy in the state constitution. Again, that's kind of what Roe hinged on. And I should say that I've only heard of a few lawmakers, really a handful, who are kind of pushing this immediate course of action anyway. The ones that I've talked to who don't support a special session say, well, I support the idea behind it, just not necessarily a special session. And we've seen courts in other states pause the implementation of these similar trigger abortion ban laws, citing Planned Parenthood's logic, and these lawmakers in Idaho don't want us to join them. I haven't seen any kind of a draft language for a potential amendment. I would kind of imagine it'd simply say that there's no fundamental right to an abortion in the state, just to make it crystal clear. With the Supreme Court giving regulatory power largely to the states, that's kind of what would hold the most power. I've asked around. It doesn't really seem likely like it's going to happen, but you never know. Right now, Governor Brad Little is the only one who could convene a special session, and his office hasn't gotten back to me.
Okay, so Jimmy, if there is not a special session this year, have you heard of any new bills around abortion that might come up in next year's legislative session?
You know, there have been a couple of ideas floated. I would imagine someone would try to pass a constitutional amendment outlawing abortions. That seems to have support from several Republicans that I've spoken with. You could also see further regulation of emergency contraception like Plan B. We don't really know yet how Idaho's laws that are on hold will affect medication abortion, if those pills come through the federal, postal service. I also talked with one of the co-sponsors of the 2020 ban a while ago, who said that legislation may be needed to make the rape and incest exceptions realistic. But I haven't heard anything concrete on that yet.
Okay. As always, Jimmy, really appreciate your reporting on this and keeping up with all of this for us. So I'm sure we will have you back on the program to talk more after the Idaho Supreme Court meets.
Happy to do it. Thanks, Gemma.
Thanks, Jimmy. We've been talking with our own Boise State Public Radio reporter, James Dawson, about Idaho's abortion laws after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the Roe v. Wade decision last month and gave the power to allow or ban abortions back to the state. Now, as we heard in the last segment with the new Supreme Court decision, the laws on Idaho's books are poised to change the way people access abortion here in the Gem State. And those laws are considered vague and ambiguous by some, especially when it comes to the definition of when pregnancy threatens the life of the mother. So here to help us better understand Idaho law on abortion is Shakira Sanders. She is a professor at the University of Idaho and a visiting professor at Penn State Dickinson Law School. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, Gemma. Thank you for having me.
So, Shakira, if Idaho's trigger law goes into effect, abortions would only be allowed in the cases of rape, in the case of incest, and if a pregnancy threatens the life of a mother. And abortion rights advocates say, that means that rape and incest survivors must first report the crime to police, and then they have to deliver a copy of that report to their doctor, and then those reports aren't publicly available while an investigation is going on. So, do we know how the rape and incest portion of this law will work?
No, we don't. Nor do we know whether rape, incest, or life are sufficient enough exceptions to a ban on abortion. As your previous guest said, what about in cases of the mother's health?
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the language in the laws about protecting the life of the mother. Do we know how that's defined in the law as it's written?
No, we don't. Now, I think a lot about the provisions of the U.S. Constitution, particularly the 5th and 14th Amendment due process clauses, which specifically mentioned life and liberty. I also think about portions of the state constitution that also guarantee due process. And so the question will be twofold, whether an exception that only mentions life is too vague, and what is the standard under which a court will make that determination? So here we have a lot of unanswered questions of U.S. constitutional law. And because we no longer have the framework that was first established in Roe versus Wade and later established in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, we're left with a lot of questions. One thing I do note, however, is in the 1992 Planned Parenthood versus Casey case, the court struck down a very similar provision that required a woman to report a rape as a prerequisite to an abortion. Now, there, that requirement that a woman report was part of a law that would have made a woman have to request spousal give spousal notification prior to an abortion. Justice O'Connor wrote that opinion and talked about how that could be too much of a burden on some women.
So we know, Shakira, since this overturning happened, that in these last couple of weeks, we've heard stories of doctors basically being on the phone with attorneys when a mother comes in an emergency situation, because, you know, rightfully so, these physicians are concerned that they could lose their license, that they could be prosecuted. And so does that, you know, that's where we get this ambiguity of, all right, is the life of the mother, if she comes in with an ectopic pregnancy, well, is her life threatened right then and there? Or is it threatened once the ectopic pregnancy bursts and then the likelihood of her surviving plummets?
Right. And for many of these hospitals, there are liability issues that could come into play in terms of civil lawsuits, because what's not also being questioned is what is the medical standard, right? Should the medical standard leave, or should this unknown legal standard leave? That puts a lot of doctors in a very tough position, and it is very unclear whether state legislatures either have the expertise or the will to clarify these things. That could mean it's up to the courts, and the courts may find that an exception that does not take into account health as well as life, and that neither seeks to clarify this issue, is insufficient and a violation of the constitutional right to due process.
So a letter from the Biden administration went out to hospitals all across the country in the last few days, and it says that if a mother's life is at risk, they must provide abortion services. And it is under a federal law. It is known as EMTALA, which is short for Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. What does this federal law say, Shakira?
Well, it seems to say exactly that. And I'm sorry, I don't have the text of the statute in front of me, but it seems to provide a very similar provision that makes an abortion required for hospitals under federal jurisdiction or that receive federal funding, that you provide abortions if it will save the mother's life. Still very unclear whether that is enough to protect the mother's health.
Okay. I want to switch back to the U.S. Supreme Court, and I want to listen to a few emails that we've received, voicemails that we've received from listeners. So this first one we're going to hear is from Greg reacting to the decision by the U.S. Supreme Court.
It is just ridiculous and unconscionable that four of the justices who just voted to rescind Roe versus Wade stated in their confirmation hearings that Roe versus Wade was settled law. So basically, they committed perjury to get a lifetime appointment on the Supreme Court. It makes no sense whatsoever.
And here is Liz, who also sent us her very strong opinion of the Supreme Court decision, and she feels the makeup of the court needs to be changed.
Horrible. The Supreme Court is not bipartisan. It is not supposed to be political or worried. We need to get a larger Supreme Court and have terms of 10 years each. This decision will bring down the economy and the well-being of this country, picking away at the lowest possible members society of our society. It is a horribly stupid decision.
So, Shakira, we've heard this question from several folks. Is it possible to change the number of justices on the court? We've heard the term packing the court, but can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so Article 3 of the Constitution, which talks about the court and the power of the court, doesn't designate a certain number. In fact, I believe the first Supreme Court had 5 members. What that means is that it is up to Congress to set the number of justices on the court. And so if you had a piece of legislation that passed both houses and was signed by the U.S. president, increasing the number of individuals on the U.S. Supreme Court, then that number could change.
Okay. So a lot of people also, and I believe Liz mentioned this, about having term limits for justices. This is a controversial topic. So let's dig into this a little bit, because I think you can look at it both ways, right? That if you do these lifetime appointments, it is supposed to give justices the ability to really not feel pressure to have to decide a certain way. At the same time, does a lifetime appointment give them too much power?
Right. You know, one thing I think about is at a time when we are consistently discussing the gender makeup of the court, the LGBTQ makeup of the court, and the racial makeup of the court. And as we begin to see the court, federal courts diversify, it is curious to me that we see a stronger arguments or louder arguments for not having lifetime appointments. The way I think about this issue is twofold. One, does Congress have the power to set how long U.S. Supreme Court justices can sit? Now, the U.S. Constitution does not say this either way. And therefore, a piece of legislation that sought to limit how long a federal judge could sit could be challenged by the court. And we very well could see a U.S. Supreme Court tell Congress that they do not have the power to limit how long an Article 3 judge can sit, right? Seeing as the Constitution is silent on the issue. And so that's the real crux here, right? Is it is unclear if Congress actually has the power to set term limits for members of the court. I'm still not quite sure if it is the length of tenure that is the problem or the failure to establish qualifications for the job that is the problem.
I am assuming that at some point in the future that SCOTUS will take up another abortion case. How likely is that, do you feel? Because SCOTUS gets to choose the cases that they take up. So even if there could be, let's say, a case in regards to religion, Shakira, because we have talked about this on the program before, that it is a Christian belief, a Christian value that life begins at conception. There have been many arguments made that the overturning of Roe v. Wade is basically no longer separating church and state because of this idea that life begins at conception. When we look at the Jewish faith, when we look at the Muslim faith, that faith, both of those faiths believe that life begins at birth. So there is an argument to be made that are people being religiously persecuted if they are not Christian? With all that said, we could see a case like that. It does not mean the U.S. Supreme Court has to hear that case.
It is very difficult for me to envision a case that would come anytime soon to the court. But I can see if we have a situation where courts are split around the country on whether or not something like a life exception without a health exception is enough, right? Courts are split on whether President Biden has the power to issue an executive order to provide any type of services, right? If courts are split, then that could precipitate the U.S. Supreme Court taking up the issue. Otherwise, it seems from the original opinion that the court is very comfortable leaving this in the hands of states, even if that means around the country, the life and health of a woman or a pregnant person could be disparately affected.
Mm-hmm. And what about this idea, Shakira, of religious freedom? And could we see a case like this go through the courts where you have people that are not Christian, of, you know, maybe they are of other faiths that believe differently? Could we see that, I guess?
Yeah, we've already seen it. There is a group of individuals who identify as Jewish who are suing the state of Florida, I believe, on that very question, saying that in the Jewish faith, life does not begin at conception. Moreover, that in some doctrines of the Jewish faith, abortions are allowed as a matter of faith. And so that very well could be a case that we see make it through some courts. And I apologize, I don't remember if that is a state or a federal court case. On the other hand, we saw a woman very recently get stopped for a traffic violation for driving in a zone where mm-hmm. you needed two people in the car. She was by herself and she's pregnant. And she says that should count as more than one person. So it very well that we could see cases like that. I think more likely making it through their way through state courts. For women of color who suffer from devastating disparities in the health outcomes mm-hmm. of their pregnancies, it very well be that we could see political pressure for more resources and studying on the issue. The same could be said for poor women as well. For mm-hmm. Idaho in particular, however, I believe that there will soon be the incompatible reality of allowing people to forego medical care for a fetus, even if medical care is needed because of criminality, whereas telling other women you have to give birth to a fetus. And so it is, I think, going to be a very unpredictable landscape.
And before I let you go, I mean, we've also seen chatter of people talking about, well, if you're going to say that life begins at conception, then we should be able to put this fetus on our tax documents as a dependent. Mm-hmm. You should be able to get child support from the time mm-hmm. of conception. The list goes on and on of things mm-hmm. that should be provided if you are saying that life begins at conception. Could we then start seeing cases like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's again the testing of the limits of life at conception, or even testing when life begins, I think is now the next wave of litigation. To the extent that the Roe court itself said we are going to avoid this question, I think we can see why.
Exactly, because it's ambiguous. I appreciate you always coming on and talking us through these issues. We've been speaking with Shakira Sanders. She's a professor at the University of Idaho Law School. She's also a visiting professor at Penn State Dickinson Law, talking about Idaho's laws restricting abortions as well as the overturning of Roe v. Wade. Again, thank you so much for helping us out today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, during this show, we have talked about Idaho's two abortion laws and how they might work. And as first reported by the Idaho Reports blog, under one of those laws, a person who performs an abortion in Idaho could be charged with a felony and could face 2 to 5 years in prison. They could also lose their medical license. The Idaho Academy of Family Physicians advocates for Idaho doctors and their patients. This group is concerned that Idaho's trigger law could create personal and professional liability for doctors. Executive Director Liz Woodruff is here to talk about the group's concerns. Liz, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me, Gemma.
So first off, can you give folks an understanding of what the Idaho Academy of Family Physicians is and what do you do?
Yes, the Idaho Academy of Family Physicians represents over 800 family doctors in Idaho. So we're the association that works to provide resources and advocacy on behalf of family physicians and their patients. What many people may not realize is that it's family doctors that most often see patients in family planning and reproductive health. It's family doctors that are in the position of helping patients prevent pregnancy, and they're also sitting with a patient when they might learn about an unplanned pregnancy, and therefore they're the ones who often provide options counseling to patients. And because a family physician sees you throughout your life, they know your medical history and are part of the conversation about your health risks, and they may be the one diagnosing a pregnancy complication like an ectopic pregnancy. They're also the doctors in the role of caring for pregnant women, helping them deliver their babies and caring for their children. So our physician members' primary concern is always for the health of their patients. And that's why we're so concerned about Idaho's trigger law.
And your group actually started planning for the reversal of Roe versus Wade before it actually happened. Tell us what you've been doing.
Well, we've been working to prepare for these changes to reproductive health access since last fall, when it became clear that we would see changes within the next year. We surveyed our members. We put together a reproductive health committee made up of our board members and our member physicians. And we learned that a majority of our members have been very clear. They want to protect the patient-physician relationship and preserve the rights of their patients to make their own medical decisions based on the advice of a trusted medical provider. So when the government starts coming into the clinic or the exam room, it puts that relationship in jeopardy, and that puts their patients' health at risk. So our reproductive health committee meets on a regular basis, has been preparing resources for our members, which are available on our website as they help their patients navigate this new terrain. And as physicians prepare for a very complicated situation when they're treating pregnant patients.
You told Idaho Reports, and I want to quote you, that, quote, governmental intrusion into the patient-physician relationship violates the core principles governing the practice of medicine, unquote. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so as I said, the patient-physician relationship is really the cornerstone of medical care, where a patient gets informed information by a medical provider with training and then can make a decision about their health and well-being. But when the government intrudes into this patient-physician relationship and interferes in the ability to treat a patient, share information with them, and assist them in the best path forward, it's really a violation of the practice of medicine. And one of the main concerns with Idaho's trigger law is that it impedes medical decision-making. And that's harmful to the patients. And it also puts physicians in a complicated situation where they're making emergent medical decisions, but they also have to weigh the legal ramifications of those decisions. And in Idaho, with Idaho's trigger law, the legal ramifications, because the law is so vague, are very unclear and are really going to complicate the delivery of medicine and put patients' health at risk.
You also said that this intrusion will endanger the lives and well-being of the woman, of the pregnant individual. Can you give us an example of how that might actually happen? And we should note that we are seeing this in other states across the country already.
Yeah, I mean, because the physician is put in the situation of having to justify the decisions that they're making in medical determinations, sometimes really emergent situations, it complicates their ability to make those decisions in evidence-based standard of practice ways. So an example like would be an ectopic pregnancy where the pregnancy is occurring outside of the uterus. In Idaho's trigger law, the law only considers a condition for which abortion is necessary to prevent the death of a woman, but we don't know what that means. Must a patient be on the verge of death to be treated? There might also be a pregnancy of unknown location, and that could become an emergency very quickly. But do we have to wait until a patient is in an emergent situation? Another example would be an early pregnancy loss. The trigger law uses the term a clinically diagnosable pregnancy, but in the case of early pregnancy loss, that would require medical intervention. This creates extreme confusion and trepidation for providers about the legal implications of proceeding with what has been the basic standard of care in this area. Another example would be in a fetal anomaly case where, as the law is currently written, fetal anomalies would still have a heartbeat. So that could be somebody that could be a fetus that has a head or a brain that, but that outside that hasn't developed a head or a brain, but does have a heartbeat. So patients with this type of pregnancy would have to leave Idaho to be treated based on the first reading of the law. And because those are very dangerous, complicated situations that when treated quickly can preserve the life of the mother before they become emergent, there's a continuum of consideration that doctors have to consider that really is going to have a negative impact on patient health, both in terms of their physical health and their mental health.
So Liz, what are you hearing from doctors? I mean, I'm assuming they are concerned about these laws, and are they worried about losing their license or potentially even going to jail over treating their patients? And I ask this because, you know, you brought up these examples, and one being early pregnancy loss, right? There are many times where you don't naturally miscarry. It doesn't happen. So you must have medical intervention so that the woman does not go septic, so that the woman doesn't, you know, eventually die. But that also doesn't happen, you know, right away. And, you know, I experienced that myself, but I wonder if that had happened now. I was like, I'm wondering, well, would my doctor have been able to give me the medically necessary treatment that I needed?
Yeah, definitely. I would say that I'm hearing from my members probably primarily that they're most concerned about the health of their patients, which is, you know, the kind of what we expect from our physicians. And certainly mm-hmm. Idaho's family physicians are very concerned about the health of their patients for all the reasons that you just stated about complications that can come in pregnancy. I think that, you know, Idaho's law is an excellent example of why medical decision-making shouldn't be legislated by people with no medical background or training. The law is so vague as to be dangerous, and it's so uninformed about the variety of medical issues, which we've already talked about, that can present in pregnancy, that it's confusing and requires a physician to weigh legal risks while making emergent medical decisions. And of course, our physicians are also very concerned about the legal implications for themselves and the practice of medicine. Family physicians and other physicians put their patients first. And now to have to navigate a law that is so vague and uninformed and really complicates their ability to make those decisions, and they have to have in the back of their mind the fact that they could face criminal prosecution and, as you said, time in prison when they're delivering medical care. It's not where we want our family physicians or any physicians to be when they're making those emergent decisions about our health.
So Liz, I know that the Biden administration just recently sent letters out to hospitals across the country, and we spoke about this in our earlier on the show. And this is the Federal Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, or EMTLA. Now, the law requires medical facilities to determine whether a person is seeking treatment, that the person seeking treatment may be in labor, or whether they're facing an emergency health situation or one that could develop into an emergency. And if so, the physician needs to give treatment. And even if that treatment is abortion care, even if it's in a state that does not allow that, they must, under this federal law, do that. I know it just came out, so I'm not sure if you've had a chance to look at this, but does this give you any hope at all in your organization?
Well, hope. I don't know about hope, but it is good that the federal government is attempting to broaden the parameters for physicians treating pregnant people facing medical emergencies. Because the executive order was just signed and HHS secretary just released more detail, we're still working to understand what it will mean for mm-hmm. Idaho. But it won't change the fact that physicians are still embroiled in a very sticky situation when they are providing yeah. emergency care. Many providers will still be fearful about being caught between conflicting state and federal law. And the question remains as to what it means that the mother's life is at risk and when a doctor can intervene. So again, physicians are going to have to test these legal parameters in real time when they should be able to focus on delivering quality evidence-based care using their clinical judgment. So I think that it's reassuring to know that the federal government is looking to make sure that the physician-patient relationship can be maintained to the extent possible. But the confusion about the interaction between a state law, like the very extreme trigger law in Idaho, and federal law, may not give a lot of reassurance to providers.
Well, Liz, I appreciate you taking time out of your day to talk to us about this. So important we're having these conversations. So thank you.
Thank you for focusing on this topic. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. We've been talking with Liz Woodruff, Executive Director of the Idaho Academy of Family Physicians, about the reversal of Roe versus Wade, as well as Idaho's law that restrict abortions. We want to end our program today on the overturning of Roe versus Wade, hearing from you. Here are two reactions from our listeners who sent us a voicemail on how they felt after the decision came down. So first, let's hear from Rebecca.
As a woman, a mother, a healthcare provider, and the wife of an OBGYN, I have a myriad of feelings about the recent court overturning of Roe. There are waves of sadness and anger, but the most powerful feeling is honestly one of hopelessness. Will my husband be a felon for providing care to the women he serves? Another question. Will my daughter grow up in a country that does not view women as equal? Because make no mistake, this is an equality issue. If women are forced to carry to term, there are lasting ripple effects for her life. I have been pregnant. I've been pregnant with desperately wanted pregnancies, and it was hard both physically and mentally. It is something that should not be forced on anyone, ever, period. Abortion is sad. No one knows this more than the women who have been forced with that choice. The choice. Adoption is not the answer. Autonomy and the right to choose in private is the answer. One last question. They call themselves pro-life, but whose life?
And here's another voicemail from Sherry. Let's take a listen.
I'm calling in to celebrate the overturning of Roe versus Wade. It's a significant step toward human rights, and I'm rejoicing today. I'm a college-educated agnostic, and I'm 100% anti-abortion. I want to live in a society that looks for life-affirming solutions. Abortion is not a human right. It's human destruction. Thank you.
And we will continue to bring you coverage of what happens with abortion laws here in Idaho. And we will keep listening to what you're saying and the questions that you want answered. Our reporter, James Dawson, will be back on the program in August as the Idaho Supreme Court hears arguments in a challenge by Planned Parenthood to Idaho's abortion laws. I want to thank all of you for joining us today. I know these are difficult conversations to be having, but they are necessary. And we hope that we all learn something more today. But as we said, we will continue to have these conversations.